Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jeremy Sherlick, senior producer of The President's Inbox. We've got an exciting new offer for you from Foreign Affairs Magazine. Published by us, the Council on Foreign Relations, since 1922, Foreign Affairs Magazine puts what's going on in the world today into perspective. Featuring analysis and insights from internationally renowned experts, Foreign Affairs is a must-read. And today, we have an exclusive, discounted, one-year subscription offer just for our podcast listeners. To receive 70% off the original cover price of Foreign Affairs, go to foreignaffairs.com/presidentsinbox and enter the promo code INBOX19. Once again, that's foreignaffairs.com/presidentsinbox and enter the promo code INBOX19. And now on to the show.
Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the Turkish invasion of northern Syria. With me to discuss the events unleashed by President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops who were working with Kurdish forces in northeast Syria are Henri Barkey and Stephen Cook. Henri Barkey is an adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies here at CFR. He is also the Bernard L. and Bertha F. Cohen Chair in International Relations at Lehigh University. From 1998 to 2000, Henri served on the State Department's policy planning staff working on the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and intelligence-related issues. Stephen Cook is the ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies and Director of the International Affairs Fellowship for Tenured International Relations Scholars at the Council. His most recent book is False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. Henri, Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
Stephen, I want to start with you, and I'd like you to do a bit of a scene setter for us and just sort of briefly sketch out why it is that there were U.S. troops in northern Syria in the first place.
It's a great question, Jim, and actually a controversial issue. American troops were in Syria because, going back to 2014, when President Barack Obama sought allies in the fight against the Islamic State, he also deployed a small number of American Special Forces operators to work with allied forces on the ground to defeat and degrade, in his words, the Islamic State. Those allied forces on the ground were a group now called the Syrian Democratic Forces. The core of that
SDF,
group, the SDF.
Okay.
The core of that group is a Syrian Kurdish fighting force known as the People's Protection Units. Its acronym now widely known, the YPG. Over the course of the last 5 years, the United States military has been working with the SDF and the YPG to fight the Islamic State. And they have been there, even though the president declared victory over the Islamic State. They've continued to be there because they want to, one, there's a number of missions for them. One, to continue to put pressure on the Islamic State as it seeks to regroup. Two, as a deterrent to Iran. Iran is working to build a land bridge from Iran through Iraq to Syria and on to the Mediterranean and Lebanon, where it can ship weapons to its allies in the region, notably Hezbollah. And then the third reason, this relatively small American force of about 1,000 people, this includes support personnel, was to provide a certain amount of leverage for the United States, or so it was believed, leverage for the United States vis-a-vis Russia, which is really the kingmaker in Syria right now. But it was believed that with this American force, the Russians could not act with total impunity and had to take into account American desires and wishes in Syria. So that's why the U.S. has been there. It's a relatively small force, as I said.
I guess you get clarification on that, Stephen, because you mentioned 1,000 troops, but that's in all of Syria, isn't it? My understanding was that the number of troops the president sort of pulled back was only on the order of about 50.
That is the number that's been bandied about, was that 50 were working up on the border between Syria and Turkey, had taken part in joint patrols with Turkish forces in the just the week before the Turkish invasion. Those forces were redeployed away from the border, which essentially made way for Turkish forces to enter into it. But now the total number of American forces, which is about 1,000, are coming out of the country.
So, Henri, explain to me the other half of this relationship. the Syrian Kurds. Stephen gave us a couple of acronyms for the forces in groups there. But why were they allying with the United States? What were they hoping to get out of this relationship?
Well, they were trying to get two things out of this relationship. One, and the first, the important reason why they first joined up with the United States, or in fact, the United States joined up with them, is because in 2014, ISIS, the Islamic State, swept through Iraq and northern Syria, essentially taking huge swathes of territory, including Syrian Kurdish territory, and they were besieging the town of Kobani. And the town of Kobani became, if you want, a symbol at the time, and they were desperate for some kind of help. The United States told the Turks to come to the defense of Kobani. Erdogan essentially refused.
Erdogan being the president, then prime minister.
Then prime minister of Turkey absolutely refused, and eventually he actually was cherishing the idea that Kobani would fall to ISIS hands. So President Barack Obama then decided to use American air power from carriers in the Mediterranean and the Gulf to help the Kurds, and that's how the relationship started. And the Kurds, with the help of the United States, pushed back ISIS and essentially liberated that territory. So the first reason is because they needed the United States air power initially to push back the ISIS. Once that succeeded, of course, they had to maintain pressure on ISIS, and they could not do it all on their own, and the United States partnered with them. But the other reason is a political one. For the YPG, which is essentially a militia, the Syrian Kurds, you have to understand, never got much from the Syrian government. In fact, the Syrian government did everything in its power to get rid of the Kurds, to get rid of them, threw them out of Syrian nationality. This gave them respect. This made them an important player because the United States, the premier power in the world, was aligning with them. So from being just a militia, they became essentially the most important militia in the world because the United States was with them. So they got a great deal of political oomph, if you want, and that was going to be parlayed eventually for some kind of local autonomy once the Syrian civil war ended.
So the Syrian Kurds were not just trying to resist the Islamic State, they had their own political project to create a Kurdish-dominated region, enclave, I'm not sure what the right word is to use, in northern Syria. It was called Rojava. Which I understand means western in Kurdish, which refers to the fact that the Kurds are spread across several countries, right? We have in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and in
Turkey.
I'm struck, Henri, you mentioned that President Obama turned to Erdogan, turned to the Turks, and asked them to come to the aid in Kobani, and Erdogan said no. Now, it was really taken, you said, and actually, Erdogan saw an advantage to Turkey in having the Islamic State come to power. I think for most Westerners, most Americans, that's a shocking statement. So can you unpack that a bit?
Well, because you have to understand that the YPG, the Syrian Kurds, I mean, this militia, which is the strongest militia, is very closely aligned with the PKK, which is a Turkish Kurdish insurgent group that both the United States and Turkey consider to be a terrorist organization. Except that the PKK, which has been fighting in Turkey since 1984, trained and in many ways created the YPG. So from Erdogan's perspective, the YPG is a force that could ultimately align itself with Turkish Kurds. It is a product ideologically and militarily of Turkish Kurds. So in his priority list, let's put it this way, the YPG and the Syrian Kurds are a bigger enemy than the Islamic State. So if you're given a choice in Kobani as who should control Kobani, which the clan of Kobani is right on the border between Turkey and Syria, he preferred ISIS.
Just to add to this discussion, at the time that the Obama administration went to the Turks and asked for their assistance on the ground, the Turks raised really two objections. The first was they said that they didn't like the anti-ISIS strategy because it didn't include an American invasion of Syria and regime change in Damascus. They said that ISIS...
So Ankara doesn't like the Assad government in Damascus.
Right. Ankara does it. The Turkish government doesn't like the Assad government in Damascus. Their feeling was, and they expressed it very clearly, that Assad is the reason for the Islamic State, which is not really true. The Turks had really been out on a limb and been very forward about Assad must go. And so this was a real kind of self-serving declaration that they didn't like the U.S. strategy because it didn't include regime change in Damascus. And as Henri said, Erdogan said at the time, for us, ISIS and the PKK are no different, which is a subtle way of saying that the PKK is our priority. And Turkish forces sat on the Turkish side of the border during the siege of Kobani, where they could see Kobani, and allowed ISIS to lay siege to this town. It wasn't until U.S. air power showed up that ISIS was beaten back. And that's really the genesis of this real rift between the United States and Turkey, because thereafter, the United States began working with the YPG, which, as Henri points out, is directly related to
the
PKK.
Henri, is Erdogan wrong when he argues that the Syrian Kurds are basically in cahoots with the PKK, that is a terrorist group in Turkey, and regarded as a terrorist group by the United States?
Yes and no. That is to say, yes, there's a very, very strong relationship between the two organizations. But the YPG ultimately is a Syrian organization, and its ambitions were in Syria, not in Turkey. And I would argue that I think Erdogan made a terrible mistake in 2014. Had he intervened to support the Syrian Kurds, he would have essentially, I would say even maybe demolished the PKK in Turkey, because he would have shown Turkish Kurds that he cares about Kurds, that he once... given the opportunity, he doesn't just want to kill Kurds, he's going to help them on a humanitarian basis. And that would have essentially alleviated many of the problems in Turkey, because the Kurdish problem in Turkey has been going on since the beginning of the last century, and it's going to continue for another couple of centuries if there's no political solution to it. The Kurds are not going anywhere. They will continue to fight.
I think that Henri is absolutely right, but I think that Erdogan's mistake in not coming to the aid of the Kurds was born of the hard realities of Turkish politics. In 2014, there were local elections in Turkey, and although Erdogan's party, the Justice and Development Party, swept those elections, if you look at the results of the elections, he did cede votes to the nationalists. The nationalists who are implacably opposed to any expression of Kurdish nationalism. And so Erdogan, already thinking forward to general elections in June 2015, had to position himself in a way that took a very, very strong stance on Kurdish nationalism, and thus was no way going to come to the aid of the Kurds, because it would have broken an alliance that he had with the nationalist right, and he might have not gotten the parliamentary majority that he so desperately sought.
Let's bring things up to where we stand right now. It has been clear for quite some time that President Erdogan wanted to launch a military operation into northern Syria. He wanted to break the back of this Kurdish autonomous region. For some time, President Trump has indicated that he was opposed. But suddenly we had the phone call earlier this month where the president decides he's had enough. In essence, he essentially says to Erdogan, go ahead if you want to do this. Why did the president change his mind, Stephen? Where does that come from?
From the very beginning, from the time that President Trump announced his campaign for the presidency, one of the things that he has talked about when it comes to foreign policy is disentangling the United States from wars in the Middle East, that no one has ever quite explained why we are there. And that is a failing, I think, of people in the Obama administration, as well as the Trump administration, to explain to the American people, as well as the president, what the purpose was for U.S. troops in Syria.
Well, let me push on that. It seems to me that whether it was the Obama administration or going into the Trump administration, there was a pretty clear message as to why we were in Syria, and that was the Islamic State. And people remember that the Islamic State were on TV cutting people's heads off, and it was important to counter them. Indeed, the president took pride, understandably so, in having defeated the Islamic State, at least in terms of its geographical construction.
Right. And the president made it clear that once the Islamic State was defeated, there would be no real reason for the United States to be in these places, and that whatever the residual problems are, there are local problems that should be handled by the locals, including Turkey. And so President Erdogan has, from the very first encounter between these two leaders, has impressed upon President Trump that the YPG is a terrorist organization, that it's a threat to Turkey. Then subsequently, after President Trump declared the defeat of the caliphate, President Erdogan has emphasized that now that the Islamic State has been defeated, there's really no reason for the United States to have a security relationship with the YPG, and that the United States should go, and that it was a security threat to Turkey, and that he was going to invade. These were bluffs as long as there were even a small number of American forces standing in the way.
Let me ask you about that, Henri, because there have been a number of claims by defenders of the president's policy that essentially he had no choice, that the Turkish military were going to come across the border. American forces, even though small in number, would be put at risk, and so the president had to sort of step back. Do you agree with that assessment that the Turks were going to go in?
Absolutely not. I think Erdogan was bluffing. As long as there is a single American soldier in northern Syria, he would not have dared to go in, because imagine the backlash in this country if Americans were to die or get wounded as a result of Turkish fire. I mean, already today we're seeing this enormous reaction and not a single American has been hurt. Imagine if that would have happened. I want to add something to what Stephen said. First of all, I mean, I don't think President Trump really understands the geopolitics and who's who in the region, but he actually tried to take the troops out earlier. In December 2018, and then there were 2,000 troops at the time, again, after a conversation with President Erdogan, he just sent a tweet and said the American troops are out of Syria.
And that was the tweet that led Secretary of Defense James Mattis to tender his resignation.
Exactly. Secretary Mattis tried to convince him otherwise, and when he couldn't, essentially pulled his resignation letter. And that created shockwaves, and the president had to back that. So the president always wanted to do that. I would suggest something else that's going on here. In 2018, in December 2018, look at the composition of the American national security leadership. You had General Mattis, you had Dunforth as chief of the general staff, you had General Votel. So you had essentially a formidable group of, national security advisor was Bolton. So you had a formidable group of people who actually knew how the bureaucracy worked, who could essentially move President Trump around, maybe even block what he wanted to do, which they did. Today, you have a new national security advisor who's very, very new to the job and to the issues. You have a new secretary of defense, you have a new joint chiefs, and you have a new commander of CENTCOM, right? So these are all brand new people who didn't know how to essentially react to, I think, to President Trump's decision, and they just went along with it.
It strikes me that the president really has, in contrast to 2018, in addition to having a formidable national security staff, the president increasingly keeps his own counsel. And we're coming up against the election season, and he has made it a point that the United States should not be in so-called forever wars around the region. I have to tell you, just as an aside, an anecdote, I was traveling yesterday, waiting to get on Amtrak, and standing next to three Amtrak police officers, heavily armed with dogs. They're in the counterterrorism mission, and I overheard them talking about the president's decision to leave Syria. And they said, well, we're getting out of Syria. I'm not even sure what we were doing there. It's a good thing. Let the people there take care of those problems. So it's clear the president understands where there are many Americans when it comes to Syria. This, I think, has created a significant uproar here, but I'm not sure how it's being received. And I think that he sees it as an overall win.
But I think it's worth pointing out that while troops may be coming out of Syria, the president at the same time is sending more troops to Saudi Arabia. So I'm not sure that the message that the United States is getting out of the Middle East is exactly spot on. But let's put that aside. And let's sort of talk about the fallout from the president's decision, because shortly after the president has this phone call with President Erdogan, the Turkish military begins to go across the border. So in terms of going back to your bureaucratic stalling point, Henri, the problem here was that you didn't have any time to stall because the Turks acted, and now things have changed. So sort of walk me through, Stephen, what has happened? What is different because the Syrians have actually gone across the border?
So after the Turkish invasion, there has been a blitz of Turkish forces, but leading the Turkish invasion are what we used to call the Free Syrian Army. This is a militia that came together in opposition to the Assad regime. In fact, the Turks had at one time offered these militias to fight the Islamic State, and in the Pentagon's judgment, they were poorly trained, poorly equipped, and riddled with extremists. And it seems that they're perhaps better trained and better equipped, but still there are elements of it that are extremist groups, and they have gone into population centers in northern Syria and already engaged in a fair amount of atrocities. The Kurds, feeling abandoned by the United States, have turned to two other actors in the Syrian conflict, the Assad regime, as well as the Russians, for support, and have invited the Assad regime into Kurdish areas. This is the first time we're seeing Syrian government forces in this part of Syria in 7 years or so. And now, to set the stage, just this morning, you have Syrian forces and Turkish forces up in a town called Manbij in northern Syria. And in between them, the Russians are patrolling the area. So the United States is out. There's a significant amount of violence The Kurds have invited the regime in. You can expect the regime to provide them enough support in order to bloody the Turks going forward and the Russians in between. Perhaps the Russians will negotiate some type of ceasefire that the United States is now calling for from outside of Syria. But that is the state of play right now. Erdogan has vowed to continue his operation. He gave a speech today and said he's going all the way to the Iraqi border.
So does that mean that the Turkish military is going to square off against the Russian military, or are they going to go around them? I mean, how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, I don't see the Turkish armed forces going up against the Russians directly. I think that there's a significant amount of coordination going on between Russia and Turkey. The Russians are playing every end of the stick here to their advantage. So one can see how the Turks will drive as far as they can go until they get a signal from the Russians that they've gone far enough. But it certainly is the case that now Russia is the primary external force in Syria that is calling the shots, and it is going to arrange those actors who are pursuing their interests in a way that maximizes Russian influence and Russia's interests. I'll point out that Vladimir Putin was welcomed quite warmly in Riyadh yesterday and is in Abu Dhabi.
Interesting photo juxtaposition, the Russian president and the leader of Saudi Arabia getting together.
And today getting together with the leader of the United Arab Emirates, two obviously strategic allies of the United States. But there is a feeling in the region, not just as a result of the position that we've taken on the Kurds in Syria, but also the attacks on Saudi Arabia a number of weeks ago, that despite the deployment of new American forces to Saudi Arabia, that these countries are really on their own.
Henri, just sort of looking at events of the past week from the vantage point of Ankara, is President Erdogan happy with how things have transpired? Does he or does the Turkish elite, Turkish government see themselves as winning in this confrontation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you have to understand that President Erdogan completely dominates not only the Turkish political scene, but the Turkish press. Every single news outlet or every single opinion-making outlet that you can imagine. So when you look at Turkey and the Turkish press, all you see is essentially enormous amount of support, which is genuine on the part of the Turks, with the exception, of course, of the Turkish Kurds who are opposed to this operation. Everybody's supporting him. So he is basking in the glory. He thinks everything is going well. Of course, I think he might be making a terrible mistake, because once his troops stop, he will be engaged in some kind of a guerrilla war, because the YPG is not going to leave him alone. But more importantly is the reaction in the United States. And what Stephen said is very important, in that everybody in the region now looks at the United States as being unreliable, that you cannot trust the United States because it will pull the rug under you without even notice. I mean, remember, President Trump did this without telling the Kurds, without even telling the military, did not even tell the French and the British, who have troops there whose lives are in danger, right? So you have that kind of an actor as the United States, so everybody is worried. I would argue that this is the action of one man, and it doesn't represent the American way of doing foreign policy and the American national security establishment. And here's what the important fight that we're going to see is, not maybe in Syria, but actually in the Congress.
Well, can we talk about that a little? I'd like both of you to explain to me why the reaction in Washington to the president's decision was so broadly based in terms of being critical. It was bipartisan. Senators like Lindsey Graham, who had been known for being the president's big defender, also Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, came out and were sharply critical of the president. Real different from what we see elsewhere. And I ask that in part because when you sort of step back and look at this issue, what we're talking about is a situation in which the United States is allied with a group in northern Syria that a NATO ally believes is a terrorist organization. And indeed, many experts in the United States have long argued that this relationship with the Syrian Kurds could not work or be sustained. Indeed, I think it was Senator Lindsey Graham himself who back in 2016 at a Senate hearing said that the alliance with the Kurds was, and I believe I'm quoting him correctly here, the dumbest idea in the world, end quote. So why this reaction?
I think there's three points. The first, and I think the most important, is ISIS. This group, this Syrian Kurdish fighting force, the YPG, lost 11,000 people, 24,000 injured in the fight against the Islamic State. And those people died and were injured So Americans didn't have to go there. They were deployed, not people from the United States.
So there's an answer to the question raised by the Amtrak security police you overheard the other day. This was in our interest because otherwise you get the Islamic State with its deep anti-Americanism, anti-Western policies.
And of course, that was my answer to them in my head, but I didn't want to get in on their conversation. And so I think that is driving much of this, this concern that we had worked with this group, we had been successful with them, and to pull the rug out from under them, as Henri said, threatens once again the possibility that the Islamic State will regroup and once again threaten countries around the region, Europe, and possibly even the United States, although I think people feel that that is a more remote chance. I think the second reason is, yes, Turkey is a NATO ally, but it's not much of a partner. As we discussed at the top of this podcast, when President Obama went to Turkey and said, hey, NATO ally, strategic partner, work with us in the direct fight against the Islamic State. You are the second largest military in NATO. You are our preference to work with. The Turks demurred. And so the Turkish concern about the YPG, while legitimate for many in Washington, became secondary to the fight against the Islamic State. And then I think there's a third thing that's going on here. There is a responsible way to leave Syria. This was not the way to do it. The president signaled in 2018 that he wanted to get out of Syria. It was then incumbent upon him to put together a policy that would get us out of Syria in a way that was responsible.
But it seems from what Henri described that the bureaucracy, the rest of the government, declined to do that because they believed in this mission. And it's quite notable how many former and even some current members of the United States military, people who were involved in the operations in Syria, have come out and been incredibly critical of the president's decision.
Well, and that's on the president because he put together a team of people who were unable to imagine how to carry out his own policy. But as I said, there was a responsible way of doing it.
Well, this is a broader problem with the administration's decision-making.
That's exactly right. So I think those three things together have created this environment where even allies of the president have been sharply, sharply critical of this step. And the Senate is now back, and they're going to be discussing ways to punish Turkey for its invasion.
But they may end up punishing Turkey. I note that the administration has begun to impose sanctions. Those sanctions seem to be modest, not the kind of sanctions one might have expected when Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin said that we could shut down the Turkish economy. But let's assume we get the debate in the Senate, we get sanctions, maybe even tougher sanctions against Turkey. The fact is the state of play in Syria has changed dramatically. This is really a phase change. We're not going to go back. Putting aside the question about whether the United States exited in the most appropriate way, what is the bottom line here for U.S. national interests? Are we better off, as the president says, to be out of Syria and let this be the Russian problem, let the Turks have to deal with it, let the Syrians have to deal with it, we move on, or have we set the stage for a problem that's going to come back and haunt us down the road, which is what the president's critics, I think, have said time and again?
Well, I think we are much, much worse off than we were earlier, because the United States was a stabilizing element in the region. Essentially, basically, it's saying it will not do that job anymore. The other thing that we have to remember is that the YPG had imprisoned 12,000 battle-hardened ISIS fighters and 40,000, more than 40,000 family members of ISIS who are very, very radical. We don't know what's going to happen to these people. They may be released or they may escape. And then in a way, what President Trump has done is has given ISIS another chance at rejuvenation. And the return of ISIS will appear as in one of the greatest mistakes that we will have made. But it's just more than ISIS coming. It's a perception. It's a way the decision making. I mean, David Sanger in New York Times today basically said this is probably the biggest strategic mistake the United States has done since 1950 in terms of the implications of this for the rest of the world. It may be an exaggeration, but the point is that that's a perception out there, and this is why Congress is so riled up about it, because Congress understands that the United States should not behave in this way because this is not the way the United States operates. And clearly, a lot of people, as you mentioned, generals and others, have essentially objected very strongly to this.
With all due respect to David Sanger, I can think of a few other things that would be much higher on my list of strategic mistakes. I don't even have to go back more than 20 years. But Stephen, what is your assessment of sort of where we stand and what this means for U.S. national interests going forward?
Well, I think undoubtedly we are worse off. As Henri articulated, the ISIS threat will reemerge in ways that will affect our allies in the region and affect our allies in Europe. One of the profound things about the Syrian conflict is how it has transformed European politics. And Europe is a core strategic interest. The stability, peace in Europe is very, very important.
And I would also note there are a lot of American citizens in Europe at any moment in time, working there, traveling there, doing research there and the like.
Indeed. And I think that the larger issue, though, is this question of American reliability and the fact that it now seems that the Russians are looked upon as a force for stability, as non-ideological, as a leader of the region. If the paradigm going forward is great power competition, and this may be a difference between President Trump and the foreign policy bureaucracy, who's the foreign policy bureaucracy seeing great power competition being the future, and President Trump not necessarily agreeing with them. But if that is in fact the case, the United States here isn't competing at all. And by its actions in Syria, by its actions in the Gulf, those countries that had previously been aligned to the United States and made it relatively easier and relatively less expensive for the United States to achieve its goals and pursue its interests in that part of the world are clearly hedging with the Russians.
There is another unintended consequence of this that people don't realize, and that is if the Senate and House resolutions on Turkish sanctions go through, those are devastating sanctions. They include complete ban on arms sales. It is exactly what happened in 1974 after the Cyprus invasion. However, this time, A, the Turkish economy is much more integrated with the rest of the world, so the Turkish economy will suffer a great deal. And as a result of this, distancing between Turkey and the United States will actually be fastened. I mean, I think you will see Turkey spinning out of American influence in the American orbit. And this will be the result of an attempt by President Trump to be nice to Erdogan. In a way, his gift to Erdogan is turning out into a poison chalice. And this is why the administration is now desperate to come up with an alternative sanctions package, which, as you pointed out, doesn't really have much in it. So they send Vice President Pence to Ankara. They now suddenly realize that what's coming down the pike in the Senate and the House is really devastating, and they're doing their best to try and block it. We'll see if they succeed.
It's going to be harder to undo the sanctions that are being considered in the Congress than to undo the sanctions that the White House wants to apply.
Right. Well, we're assuming, of course, that the White House doesn't veto a bill that comes out of Congress. It may. And then it'll become the question of whether or not Congress can muster the votes to override a veto. I'll simply note that the record of Congress's overriding foreign policy vetoes is pretty dismal. I think about one in the last 35 years. So not an impressive streak. Stephen, I just want to go back, touch lightly on the question you mentioned about great power competition, because buried in there is another question, which is this the right competition for the United States or the right place to play out that competition? That's a much bigger question. Maybe sometime we'll have you back on and we can sort of talk about great power competition in the Middle East and whether it makes sense for U.S. national interests. On that teaser, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. Again, my guest had been Henri Barkey and Stephen Cook. Henri is an adjunct senior fellow here at the Council, and Stephen is a senior fellow here at the Council. So Henri, Stephen, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host. I guess that's me or my guests, and not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Anthony LeBarry was a recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.